We can start maybe. So thank you, Antonella, for joining the Cafe Club. Usually we recap, well, really we tell something about the speaker. I got the on LinkedIn and some former web page. So please correct me if I'm wrong. I know that you graduated you studied astronomy and physics in Rome, then you moved to University College of London for the PhD, working with Ofer, I guess, Ofer Lahav, for about 4 years, if I remember correctly. And then you finally moved to as Kavli Fellow to the to Kavli or Fermilab in Chicago, anyway. Was working within the Dark Energy Survey collaboration, and since you're in US, maybe also earlier with DESI and collaboration, right? Paying strong large attention to gravitational waves, to cosmology with the gravitational waves, combining gravitational waves and galaxy surveys. If I forgot something important, please feel free to remind the people attending. So it's up to you.
Yeah, please. Sure. Thank you for the introduction. Yeah, that's about right. Yeah, I'm really involved in the Dark Energy Survey and the Dark Energy Spectroscopy instruments. These are the main two things I do, and then I also started working on LISA. But today I will focus on gravitational wave cosmology with galaxy surveys, and mostly on the Dark Energy Survey. So DESI is just starting. It just started like 2 days ago to take data for the survey validation. So I'm sure I'll have a lot of results for next year, but not yet. So, okay, let me start by giving you an outline. So first I will tell you about gravitational wave standard sirens with a brief introduction about the Dark Energy Survey. Then I will move on to where we stand in terms of measurements with standard sirens, and then I will move to prospects for the future. And then I will tell you something about how we can measure, use peculiar velocities with gravitational waves to measure the growth of large scale structure in the universe. And then at last, I'll briefly touch on how we can use also host galaxies and how they're connected with the origin of binaries. So you'll see a couple of acronyms in my slides, NS for neutron stars, BH for black hole, BNS for binary neutron star, and same for binary black hole, BBH. And then SBH is neutron star black hole. Okay, a few words about the Dark Energy Survey, in case you're not familiar with it. So this was a six-year survey that ended last year in 2019. So we finished taking data then, but of course we're still working on the analysis. It takes about a year or so just to finish the calibration. So then that's when we start moving on with the science with those data. So at the moment we're mostly working on the year three data. So the observations from the first 3 years that cover the full DS footprint, which is what you see here in the bottom as a tongue shape. So the Y3 or year three data cover all of this region, but we're moving on to year five analysis. So the year five are just same footprints, but a little bit deeper than the year three data. And there's a lot of public data already from year three. The next data release is actually coming up very soon in January. So I encourage you to go to this link and look at the data if you're interested. So the Dark Energy Survey was carried out with a dark energy camera, which you see the focal plane here on the right. And this was a great instrument, and it still is a great instrument for gravitational wave, optical, and near infrared follow-up, at least in the southern hemisphere. And the main reason being that it has quite a large field of view, 3 square degrees, and it's mounted on the Blanco 4-meter telescope that allows us to go quite deep in our observations, and it covers the optical to near infrared, which is where we expect a lot of the emission from kilonovae that we expect to see from binary neutron star mergers. And so we can observe it very well with the DCAM filters. The DES programs were one, the wide field survey, which is what I told you about, 5,000 square degrees in GRI, Z, and Y. And then a supernova survey, which went deeper in only 30 square degrees, a few patches of the sky that were observed repeatedly more or less every week. And then we also did follow-ups of transient events, including high-energy neutrinos from IceCube and, of course, gravitational wave follow-up of LIGO and Virgo events. And even though DS is over, we're still doing gravitational wave follow-ups with the dark energy camera. So let me tell you how we can use gravitational waves to do cosmology in terms of standard sirens. So standard sirens work pretty similar to supernovae, as they can be used as standard candles. So from the gravitational wave signal, you can infer the luminosity distance of the source. And then if you're able to identify a host galaxy from your galaxy survey, say, then you're also hopefully able to get a redshift for the host galaxy. So you can relate these two, populate this Hubble diagram with several events once you have them, and then fit the distance redshift relation, which will be in turn sensitive to cosmological parameters, and in particular to H naught, to the Hubble constant, at least in the lowest distance range, which is mostly what we are considering here. Now standard sirens can be used in several ways. The ones I'll consider in this talk are only those that use information from galaxies. So there's other ways that take into account, for example, some mass function, and so that way they can break some degeneracy in the parameter inference from the gravitational waves, and they don't need an actual galaxy. But of course, if you can identify a counterpart and get a host galaxy redshift, that's the cleanest way of making a measurement of cosmological parameter. And so in this case, when you have a counterpart, hopefully from Berenice stars and some, at least, interstellar black hole mergers. And in this case, we talk about bright standard sirens. And then the other possibility is that when you don't have an electromagnetic counterpart, then which is what we expect from binary black holes and also many neutral star black holes, you can do something different that we call a dark standard siren or the statistical standard siren method. And what you do in this case is take the localization region that you see here as an example with this 50-90% credible interval lines about the area that we get from the gravitational wave signal. And you can take into account all of the potential host galaxies that fall within this region. And so that's why we call this a statistical method, because we take them into account within a statistical framework. And so the map that you see here is the distribution of galaxies, in this case, from the dark energy survey. And so the large-scale structure will give us some information about the redshift that you need to make this inference of the cosmological parameters. So let me remind you very quickly where we stand in terms of the bright standard siren measurement. So this was done for GW170817, which was the first gravitational wave from a Berenice star merger and also the first gravitational wave event to have an electromagnetic counterpart. So of course the method was applied for the first time to this event, but this is history now. What happened later is that we applied this method to binary black holes. And you might wonder why we want to do this method, which seems much more complicated than the case in which you have a counterpart. And the reason for that is that, first of all, we have factor 10, maybe even more at this point, binary black hole events than we have binary neutral star events. So at least the statistics are on our side, even though from just one event, it will be the precision of the measurement will be less precise because you have to marginalize over all of the potential host galaxies versus just having one host galaxy. And also, as we learned from the last Leibniz observing run, we will miss some counterparts also to binary star neutral star black holes. So one can apply this method also to binary stars and neutral star black holes. Now this slide, shows you what happens, how the method works on simulation, so that you better understand how dark standard sirens work. So here I'm showing you simulated gravitational wave events on a DES-like galaxy simulation. So what I did here is injecting gravitational wave events, assuming a cosmology with H naught of 70 kilometers per megaparsec, per second per megaparsec. So this is what you see here by this, with this dotted line. And then here, if you focus on the top plot, you have 100 posteriors on the Hubble constant that come from 100 different events. And a couple of those are highlighted in color, and the others are this gray region. So as you see, there are several peaks in this H-naught posterior. And this is totally expected because that corresponds to the large-scale structure along the line of sight. So if you have only one galaxy, you probably going to just see one peak, which depends on the redshift of the host galaxy. If you have multiple galaxies along the line of sight, then you see different peaks. But the important thing is that after you combine enough events, you are able to recover the input value of H naught. And you see the combination of all the events here in the black posterior. And then what happens when you increase the uncertainty on the distance or on the redshift, is what happens when you look going from the top panel to the middle, and then when you increase the redshift uncertainty, it's like going from the middle panel to the bottom panel. So the peaks just become broader. But again, even in this case, you're still able to recover the input value of H naught. Now, the important thing that I want you to remember from this slide is that if you look at this bottom plot, most of the posteriors have one or maybe two very broad peaks. And some of them don't even peak that much. If you look at the orange one, don't even peak that much at 70, the input value. So we're really not doing any precision cosmology from just one event. We'll need many events, and that's the strength of this method. So where do we stand at the moment in terms of dark center star measurements? So during the last observing run from LIGO and Virgo, there were more than 50 alerts and no convincing counterpart was found. So I encourage you to go look at this two papers that we put out from the DES-GW, the DES gravitational wave search team. And there were actually a few other events that we followed up, but so far nothing very interesting. So of course, the only thing we can do in this case is use dark center star method. And the way we do that is by focusing only on the best localized events. So the best localized events will have less galaxies. So you have to marginalize over less galaxies and you get the best constraints only from these events. So one is GW170814, which is actually an event from O2, the second LIGO-Virgo observing run. So this was the first measurement of the Hubble constant using a binary black hole. But now from the third observing run, we have another very well localized event that falls right in the middle of the DES footprint, as you see here. And that is GW170814. And this is a very interesting event per se, because it contains either the lightest black hole or the heaviest neutron star ever discovered in a binary. So still unclear whether this is a neutron star black hole or a binary black hole. So it's also very interesting for dark center stars because in terms of volume, this is the best localized event after GW170817. And it also has an improved distance localization from higher order modes that brings it down to an 18 square degrees localization and a distance of about 240 megaparsecs. The other improvement that we made in this new paper was to include a better treatment of the photometric redshifts, where we take into account the systematics that that can influence our H naught estimate, thing that we didn't do before just because the uncertainties are so large that they were not going to be relevant. And in fact, they are not relevant, not even in this case. So this is our final result. So in dark blue, you see the combination of the dark center siren analysis from these two events that I just showed you. And then we combine this with the GW170817 posterior that you see, for which you see the posterior here actually in gray. And the combination with this other event, which actually is not the LIGO-Virgo result, but something that our DES colleague remade using a better treatment of the peculiar velocities, and that the combination is shown here by the red line. So what the dark standard sirens do, they do provide actually a substantial improvement to the bright standard sirens. In this case, it's an 18% improvement. And if we were to think about combining all of the O1 to O3 events, so all that we have so far, we could get to a 30% improvement on the bright standard siren method. But I think that the very interesting results will come as we get to LIGO and Virgo working at design sensitivity. So this could be already at the next observing run. And the reason I say this is what you already saw from the simulation projection. So you need something like 100 well-localized events to get an interesting constraint. And we will get there probably in a couple of years. So here what I'm showing you is posteriors from predicted simulated binary black hole mergers on a simulation of GES galaxies. And so in this case, what I'm using is about 200 gravitational wave detections up to 900 megaparsecs. So I restrained the redshift range to be close to where we are more sensitive to the Hubble constant. And the combined constraint is shown here by this black curve. And we can get down to a 2 to 5% statistical precision depending on how many of this golden events, these events that really only contain a few galaxies, that will really drive down the precision uncertainty on H naught. So this is what we expect to get on after a few years, about 2 years of LIGO and Virgo running at design sensitivity. Now let me move on to how we can measure peculiar velocities with gravitational waves. Let me first remind you what galaxies' peculiar velocities are. So they are the motion of galaxies on top of their cosmological expansion. They, of course, follow the inhomogeneous clustering of large-scale structure and also the laws of gravity. So this means that if one is able to measure the peculiar velocity fields, then one is also able to probe the growth of large-scale structure and the gravity. So one possibility of doing that is by using, for example, redshift space distortion, or one can use just the galaxies that have a distance measurement. So historically, this can be done with fundamental plane galaxies or Tully Fisher. But more recently, this method has been extended to using distance indicators such as supernovae type 1. And in this work, we suggest also that it's possible to use gravitational wave binary neutral stars to do something similar, because they also provide a distance measurement. Now, this distance measurement has to be very precise, so that's why we, to be competitive at least with other probes, so that's why we only consider binary neutral stars from next generation gravitational wave detectors, so things like the Einstein telescope or the Cosmic Explorer, and we make a forecast for the cosmological parameter. So we use a peculiar velocity power spectrum, Hilbert density power spectrum, and the cross correlation of these two. So all of those power spectra depend on this product here, the growth rate times the linear growth factor, FD, which you can translate into F sigma H as well. So this is what I'll show you in the next plot. And this in turn depends on the omega matter, but also on this growth index gamma, which depends on gravity. So this is the parameter we want to constrain to discern between different gravity models. So first, what we do is we fix gamma to the value of GR, and we make a forecast for this F sigma 8 combination of cosmological parameters as a function of redshift. So we divide into three redshift beams, out to redshift 0.3, and the expected constraint on F sigma 8 from third generation gravitational wave detectors, plus the overdensity power spectrum from galaxy surveys. In this case, we consider an Amber density of about the one that is expected for DESI and for Taipan in the south, because we are considering an almost all sky survey where we have gravitational wave detections over almost the whole sky, and then two redshift surveys in the north and in the south hemisphere. So the final constraint is shown here by this blue triangles. And so, as you can see, this measurement already seems pretty interesting compared to other existing measurements of this parameter combination, and that's at around a 3% precision on estimate. And we compare this also with the expectation for future supernova survey here in the orange triangles. And of course, supernovae are really good at this probe, so they are very competitive, but the fact that we can get close to them, except for maybe the last redshift beam, because we're considering a constant distance uncertainty from the supernovae, while for the gravitational waves, the distance uncertainty increases with distance. So it gets worse as we go farther. Now here you see that there are these different prediction of F sigma 8 for different values of the growth index gamma, and these are different values that are expected within different gravity theories, such as DGP gravity and FOR. So it's clear that if you can measure this well, F sigma 8, then you can also discern between these different predictions. So the next thing we do is let the growth index vary, and see what type of constraint we can get. So the value of this constraint is given here by the color. And in this plot, you see on the x-axis, basically the number density of sources, gravitational wave sources integrated over time. In this case, I'm not considering over density, the over density power spectrum from the galaxy survey, but only from these gravitational wave sources. So they're much more sparse. Then on the y-axis, this is the distance uncertainty at redshift 0.1. And as I told you, the distance uncertainty would scale with redshift. So for an Einstein telescope, just one detector, we expect to be around this white triangle, so below the 0.04 line, which is where we want to be if we want to be able to discern between different gravity models at least these popular gravity models that I mentioned earlier, at a 3 sigma level or so. So this type of probe will be able to do that. And then things get much better if you have two or three even Einstein telescope detectors like. And this is something that could be possible, maybe also if we have maybe two Einstein detectors and one cosmic explorer and things like this. So if we are in this scenario, then we'll live closer to the 0.03 line in the bottom of this plot. Now, the last thing I want to quickly mention is, I've been working on relation between galaxy evolution and gravitational wave sources. And in particular here, I wanted to show you the possibility that binary black holes, the binary black holes, at least the more massive one that LIGO and Virgo have been detecting, could be the central black holes of very low, very tiny, very low mass dwarf galaxy. So we're thinking something around 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6 solar masses. And in particular, this was interesting for this new event, GW190521, where the component masses were found to be in the so-called mass gap, the high mass gap at least. Where we do not expect to really see black holes from stellar evolution. So here you see that this two masses are somewhere around, I think, 62 and 85 solar masses. And so if we think about extrapolating down the known relation between the mass of the black hole, the central black hole, and the stellar mass of the host galaxy, then we can infer, again, what the host galaxy of this black holes would be. And again, this is around between 10 to the 5 and 10 to the 6 solar masses. What we do is think first of all whether there are ever enough galaxy mergers in the universe of this low mass dwarf galaxy so that the central black holes would meet each other and then merge, giving rise to these gravitational wave events. So if you look at these are just different prediction of the expected number of mergers for these galaxies here in the dashed and solid line as a function of redshift. So we find that we match the expected rate from LIGO and Virgo at around between redshift 1 and redshift 1.5 or so. And so the range here is given by this red lines. This is showing what is measured for this type of binary black hole mergers from LIGO and Virgo. And so we can match it, and this would imply, given the redshift of this particular event, a time delay. So the time between the formation of the binary, or at least the galaxy merger here, and their merging of about five giga years or so. So we find that dynamical friction could explain that timescale, and that if these two galaxies with the central black holes were to meet each other, the actual central black holes could merge within something like 5 giga years. So I think I'm out of time, so I'll just leave you with my conclusions here. And I'll take any questions.
That's perfectly on time, Antonella. Don't worry. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your nice, very, very, very nice talk. I'm waiting for questions on the chat. Please raise your hand or unmute your micro. Otherwise, I have at least a couple of questions. I don't see questions for the moment. So let me start the questions. Can you show again the plot in which you show the contour plot of the errors on the gamma parameters as a function of the nt times, here it is, yeah. Which is the range of LISA in this plot? The possible range. Here I see the range for the Einstein's telescope, yeah? Can we do something with LISA in this direction? Or is the type of gravitational wave signals not well suited for this kind of measurement?
Yeah, so I think it's not well suited, but maybe I missed something. Okay. So the reason for that is that so in order to be competitive with something like supernovae, we want to have something that has a decent, at least, volumetric rate. So also we want this to be at low redshift. So as you can see from here, if you want to discern between different values of gamma, you want to be at low redshift. So you really need, because the volume is smaller at lower redshifts, you really need something that has a large volumetric rate. So definitely massive black hole binaries, I think, from LISA are not, don't have a high enough rate to be competitive here. And then there is the question of stellar black holes, stellar mass black holes that also LISA could be detecting. But again, the volumetric rate of binary black holes is still lower than binary neutron stars, at least for now. So unless something, unexpected happens, I think that with current rates, I don't think there's anything interesting, but who knows? Maybe there's something that we're missing.
I see a question just before this next question. Just a curiosity about this plot. Here you show a prediction, a combination between Taipan and DESI. Taipan is a south base, even though the sky coverage is quite large, while DESI is on Mayal. So, don't know. Which is the superposition of the two surveys?
So it's not a superposition. It's in fact so, because I'm considering gravitational waves over the entire sky, or almost. No, I'm cutting some sources because maybe, so here we need to see the counterpart, maybe we will not be able to see them on the galactic plane, so I'm cutting some sky from there, but then I'm considering the galaxy surveys both as comparison and as added over density power spectrum, both in the north and the south. So yeah, maybe I should have said Taipan plus DESI.
No, that's clear. Because, well, I expect that instead of using DESI, if you mention a foremost, which is the southern part of the DESI, the improvement will be even larger. Okay. So we have a question by Elena, right?
Yeah, so very nice talk. Thank you. So I have a question, maybe naive. So what's the fraction of gravitational waves you cannot associate to standard sirens?
So you mean... that do not have a counterpart, or that we cannot use?
Just that maybe have a counterpart that you don't know precisely the distance of.
Okay, so I think that, first of all, the more distance it is, the distance uncertainty scales with the distance. So of course, the farther you go, the less precise your distance measurement will be. But of course, at the moment with current generation gravitational wave detectors, we're really not going beyond, at least for binary neutrons, are beyond 200 megaparsecs. But anything closer will be a much better standard siren than anything at 200 or more megaparsecs. But then in terms of binary black holes, yes, once you go out to redshift to 0.5 or more, yes, I wouldn't use them as standard sirens because the distance uncertainty is just so big.
Okay, so because my question was related to the fact that would you gain something if you could know the peculiar velocity of a larger sample of objects? So correcting the distance.
Yes. Well, again, if we are interested in measuring, in probing gravity, I think we don't want to go beyond redshift 0.3. But then I'm not showing you another plot. I didn't show you this plot, but I have another somewhere. Another plot that shows that precision. Oh yes, maybe. Well, okay, this is different, but okay. So as a function of the maximum redshift. Well, maybe this is not good though because it's using the galaxy. Sorry, I have so many. Okay, I think I don't. Oh no, here. Yes. Okay. So this is the same, just as a function of the maximum redshift. When you go a redshift 0.2, so for example, if we want to follow this 0.03, but even 0.04 line, because of that reason of the distance scaling, then you're really maxed out already at redshift 0.2. So by adding more sources here, you don't gain anything on your precision in measuring gamma. Does that answer your question?
Yes, yes. Thank you. Yeah.
Sorry, still on peculiar velocity, you show the results, the improvement when you model the peculiar velocity. Which kind of model did you use? And do you expect that with a better model or with the best model, you can further improve, and at which point you can prove the constraint on H-naught?
So there isn't really a modeling here. So some modeling maybe you need to do in the standard siren case, right?
I'm talking about the modeling of peculiar velocity.
So you're thinking about the actual functional form here.
Next.
So here the improvement that I'm showing is
slide number 16.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Velocity. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes. So, yes.
You got an improvement with some modeling of the peculiar velocity. So the first question is, which kind of modeling do you use here? Oh. If the linear one, the simplest one, and how much can you gain if you improve this modeling?
Yeah. Okay. So actually, the improvement is not an improvement in the precision. It's actually worse. So peculiar velocities are really hard to measure especially when you just have one event around the gas. So in this case, we're subtracting out the peculiar velocity, but you have to be careful because there are some different ways of measuring the peculiar velocities. And so in this case, basically, what these colleagues were doing were they were just marginalizing over all the different methods that can be used. So for example, using different apertures around the host galaxy in this case to measure the peculiar velocity. So if you use a different aperture around it, you'll measure a different peculiar velocity. So you have to marginalize over this choice, over this modeling that you do basically to be fair in terms of the peculiar velocity treatment. Otherwise, you might get a biased result. So you're subtracting out the component that goes into the measured redshift that comes from the peculiar velocity because you just want to look at the Hubble expansion component. And so if you subtract out something that you're not sure about, you might get a biased result. So you need to take into account this uncertainty so that you're not biasing your result.
Yeah, so if you subtract the right amount of velocity because of someone in the Christmas period tell you which is their exact velocity, what do you gain at best?
Well, so I think here the improvement was, the uncertainty on each knot got worse by something that is probably less than 5%. So it's not huge, but you know, as we start combining events, especially if they're all coming from low distances, like in this case at 40 megaparsecs. So if we imagine that all the events are 50 megaparsecs, I think I have also another plot on this, then this is actually an important effect. For one, maybe not, but here, oh my God, how do I go back? Here, yes. So here, imagine if we just go, our distance reaches only out to 250 megaparsecs and that event was at 40. So here you see that this is the uncertainty on each knot as a function of number of events. Then for different values of uncertainty on your peculiar velocities, you live in this wide range of parametric space. So it can make an actual difference. And then when you go at larger distances, if you imagine to be able to see counterpart out to 200 megaparsecs, you see that this does not have really much of an impact on the precision of each knot. So it doesn't really matter because the main uncertainty will come from the distance rather than from the...
Thank you.
Can I ask a question, please?
Please.
How strong would you estimate is the influence of strong lensing, magnification via strong lensing on your results?
So all the things that I am considering here are very low redshift. So since strong lensing is quite a rare phenomenon, it's unlikely that it could happen. But I know that there have been some papers on, especially for that the first event, GW170814, the first binary black hole that I mentioned, that was one of those events that for which there were some papers claiming that that could have been a strongly lensed black hole, like one of the two images of a strongly lensed binary black hole merger. But according to the LIGO experts now, I wouldn't know. They say that is not true. But yes, again, it's a rare event. Maybe at some point we will be in that position, but I don't expect it to happen often, at least for the low redshift events I'm considering here. So they are at, yeah, so 170817 was at 40 megaparsecs. The binary black hole was at 400 megaparsecs, so that was the farthest away. And then the other one that is unclear if it's a neutral star black hole or a binary black hole was at only 240 megaparsecs. So very unlikely. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Any other comment or question? If not, I'd like to thank you again, Antonella, for this very nice talk and wish you to you and to everybody a Merry Christmas. Take care for holidays. And the next Cafe Club will be on January, already scheduled. So please have a look at the dedicated webpage. And take care. See you. Bye-bye, everybody.
Thank you.